Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eyes of Truth. Today, we're fortunate to have a veteran of the Russian army, Seth Nunn. He is well, I don't know if we call it expat or an immigrant, probably more an immigrant from the U.S. Because the expats, they go back. They're only here for to earn some money and do some work. So, you're as far as you're planning on staying. So I guess immigrant would be the proper term, but he's a veteran of the Russian army and from the SMO. We will discuss with Seth all of the usual stereotypes that are thrown around by the West and what his own experience was.
Something feels off. Same news, same noise, different day.
Maybe you're just in the wrong place, mate.
Wait, what?
Maybe you've been here before.
I was what? I am a Cossack.
Wait, I remember this. I was a merchant.
Okay, this is getting weird. I was a Russian musician.
Okay, this is NOT what I expected.
Yeah, happens to everyone.
We just moved. Moscow Connect helped with everything.
Visa, paperwork, life is sorted.
Wait, it's actually that simple?
Maybe it's not about escaping.
Maybe it's about finding where you actually belong.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That would be a good round number for the summer. So let me know. Leave some comments and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers. Seth, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Stanislav.
So, where are you from originally? What part of the U.S.?
I'm from Rock Hill, South Carolina. The state of the old lousy bastard known as Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, that old. Oh, you mean light in the loafers, Lindsey?
Yeah. Oh man, the gay faggot done.
Yeah, the I'm just amazed he keeps getting reelected by South Carolina, of all places. California, I could probably understand, you know, but Florida maybe. But South Carolina is that's amazing.
Dude, the amount of idiocy there in that state is unbelievable. I actually saw it everywhere on the street in the city of Rock Hill, where they were just flying nothing but Israeli flags, big Israeli supporters. Yep.
Really. That's interesting. Lindsey's definitely one of those. He makes a lot of cha-ching every time something goes boom.
The amount of blood on his hands from those money that he made, I mean, it's just diabolical.
Oh yeah, that man is. Well, as he said, you know, I have to go back to my contingency, and tell them why their boys and girls have to go die in. Like, why do they have to go die for somebody else?
They don't have to die for them for nothing, because it's not their nation to fight for.
Right, exactly. So when did you, first of all, you arrived in Russia in what year?
I arrived here last year on January the 14th. And on my way here, I got to learn more about the outside world of the United States. Mm-hmm. This is my first time ever traveling outside of the United States. I never travel anywhere else in the United States because I had enough information to not to. Because I grew up in a society in my time of generation, because I was born in 1999, the way I started growing up in a society of social decay, which means that a nation of people that don't respect themselves, literally don't respect themselves, and don't even care about the nation or being patriotic anymore towards America, like, at all. You have a lot of rednecks or vet bros. I hate the living crap out of them because they're nothing but war criminals. But they still have this feeling of being patriotic towards what they believe and fought for, even though they committed nothing but war crimes in Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now trying to commit it in against the Persians in Iran, which that didn't work out very well, we all know.
Yeah, the Persians just said no. Pushed back. What attracted you, or what got your attention for Russia, for special military operation? I mean, it's a pretty big move. It's a pretty big jump from Rock Hill, South Carolina.
It is a big jump, and also I struggle a bit with the financial situation because I was trying to make money during the inflation. But what got me interested in Russia, I guess we got to go back to when I was 5 years old, because this is when I was learning about the Chechen wars with Akhmat Kadyrov and Ramzan Kadyrov and Akhti Amatyrov. If I may have flunked his name a little bit, General Akhti Amatyrov. Very good guy, badass, a hero of Russia, and a hero of, if I'm not mistaken, hero of Lugansk, if he earned the medal of the hero of Lugansk.
I think he did.
Yeah. His father is also the reason why I had a lot of respect for, learned about, and along with Vladimir Putin, and a lot of people like to badmouth Vladimir Putin for what he is, but he's the only one that brought Russia back on its feet from the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And it'll be 1991. And this man, I mean, God bless him. He is a true human being. He is a real leader, a real realist and a real leader for a man that he is. So I study about the Chechen wars. They had two wars. Very horrible. Grozny literally looked like the city of Stalingrad, just rubble, like the Rathstaffen. That's what the Germans call it, the city of rats. Just terrible, gruesome, and gore fighting, just street fighting all over the place. But when the war ended, like Scott Ritter calls it, another man I respected, he called it the Chechen miracle, which that's how I see it, because they actually sat down, talked it out, and talk out the respect of boundaries. Like, what's the boundaries of respect that we had to work towards to build the trust and relationship again for us to rebuild from this damage of the war that's been fought here? And it worked out quite well. They went through certain negotiations, certain treaties, certain policies, and certain financial institution to rebuild the economy, and also rebuild Grozny. And it all worked out very well, and they achieved peace until they ended up assassinating Akhmat.
Yep.
And after learning about this, I was just only 5, by the way, still learning how to read, but I got more interested into reading the histories of wars. That's how I ended up learning about Russia and also the Soviet Union. And the more I learned about Russia, the more I started falling in love with Russia even more, to where I had more respect towards Russia than I had towards the United States. Because the United States, in my time of generation, was a nation already dying because of the lack of choices of policy that they were choosing to follow. The same mistakes that Britain, Spain did when they were a strong empire of a superpower. I suggest people to actually learn from these two empires, including the Soviet Union, is also the third one. That when you start literally, what's the word here? I'm still a little bit brain dead. I literally had 3 hours of sleep, so I'm literally struggling.
No problem.
Yeah. When you start diversifying your currency, taking the gold standard off, and start mixing pure silver with copper and also iron. I think they started mixing iron with silver when it was supposed to be pure silver. And also, literally, a nation in debt where you still got to pay off the nation that you borrowed from. And then have a society of social decay, loss of industrial capacity, and currency, the basement of debt spiral. It ends up killing the nation from within.
Yep. Yeah, that's usually how it runs. So what, the final move, I mean, to Russia from the U.S.
Well,
it couldn't have been the easiest of decisions. I'm sure your family probably.
Well, it wasn't, because you see, it's kind of a sad story how I got here. Before the operation started back in February 24th, 2022, if I got my date correct.
Yep.
That time, my grandmother was diagnosed with cancer. Oof. She was diagnosed with two cancer, multiple myeloma and bone marrow disease. Oof. And that was when I was trying to get over to Russia and join the special military operations, because I knew when I started to see how Boris Johnson was reacting towards Russia and Ukraine, I knew this son of a bitch was going to nuke the peace deal push the Ukrainians into a war, which was the biggest mistake for Ukraine.
Oh, yeah.
Suicide. And when I was trying to get over here, I screwed up on, you see, I had two guns with me, a 1911 Kimber and an Austrian 45 Glock. I think it'd be a 43 Glock, one of those mini pocket-sized pistols. I screwed up by showing up in the airport with live ammunition in my pocket, because I was in such a rush on the time of catching the flight. I didn't check my pockets before I left. And so I got detained and got charged with having a non-weapons concealed permit. That's the only thing I got charged for, nothing else. Plus, I was in a military uniform when I arrived. So a lot of red flags that happened there, because I was in just such a rush. And also not thinking, but when I arrived back home and got bailed out of jail in the York County Mecklenburg prison, well, it would still be a jail. I ended up thinking a lot about the early stages of every war, so where it just goes straight bull on to chaos, where a lot of people mostly die in the first stages of the war. So I just sat back, started re-strategizing, and studied the war, what's actually happened over there. And this is when I started seeing Yevgeny Prigozhin start doing his offensive in Bakhmut. A hell of a battle of the 21st century. I watched the entire thing for, I think it lasted close to 6 months, I believe. Yep, 6 months of fighting. And 20,000 Wagner fighters died in Bakhmut, along with 90,000 Ukrainians that just got absolutely slaughtered.
Yeah, Prigozhin, you know, most of the Wagner people that Prigozhin tossed in, they weren't Wagner, like career Wagner. Those are mostly the guys he's pulling in from prison.
They were just jail gangs and prisoners.
Right. Actually, it was forbidden for him to continue recruiting, because he wasn't providing any training for them. They were getting like the very minimal training. I mean, I've seen Russian, they're not hardcore criminals. They get a pardon for joining the Russian army, but these units they get full training. Prigozhin wasn't doing that. He was just giving them minimal training and then tossing them in there, and then getting photos made in front of their corpses, going, "See, you know, this is all wrong. You're not giving me."
I believe that's what Putin also despised from the man, because he was just basically sending a good man in there to die for nothing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I thought about joining Wagner until I looked around and I saw how they were fighting. I'm like, no. This is it's all pretty pointless, the way he was
running. Well, this is also basically how the French did it to their prisoners as well. They gave them guns, and sometimes guns with no bullets, just plain gunpowder inside of the musket, thinking it was actually loaded, but all they were just shooting was just powder.
Yeah, yeah. So that was Prigozhin was There's still people that believe Prigozhin was a patriot. I'm like, oh, he wasn't a patriot.
I believe Chris also said that as well, because he signed his contract with Yevgeny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got my views on that. And I talk to a lot of generals and colonels and guys on the front lines, and Prigozhin was a disaster. Which, by the way, the U.S. Congress knew about.
Yeah. Probably nothing. Make money off of it.
Oh yeah, there was the Group of Seven, the seven senators, the most powerful senators. They get the special briefings. They were boasting and bragging that there's going to be a revolt in the Russian military 2 days before Prigozhin did his little thing. So obviously he.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
I remember them trying to march onto Moscow, which it was. To me, it didn't even look like a revolt almost, because all the armed forces, including the civilians, just started volunteering to stop this entire madness. It was just basically mostly entire of a nothingness that was just happening.
I think he thought the people were going to rise up for him. Big mistake.
If you learn from the history from the Soviet Union, it doesn't work out very well.
Well, he tried. He tried. He was gonna save Putin from his ministers by taking power, so
not working out very well right here, because you're dealing with an ex KGB agent.
that was not the smartest thing. So what happened after that? How did you get over?
Well, I'm about to get to the sad part. After being bailed out, and I actually got my record sponged out, because in return, I went to the judge. I didn't even get to speak to the judge. The lawyer did the speaking for me. And my record was purely clean, and the judge kind of scratched her head. Like, I can literally see how she was just scratching her head, because she was probably thinking, it ain't worth trying to charge this guy any further. I'm just going to give him this option, and he'll just take it. Basically, the option was surrender the firearms and just go to therapy for 8 months, and then your record will be just sponged clean. So that's what I just did. So I just fooled around, played around, because I ended up getting the FBI involved. So I had to end up playing this stupid game saying I was just going over to fight for Ukraine, but really I was going to fight for Russia.
Right.
And these idiots kind of just bought it.
That'll free you from anything. Try to shoot Trump, as long as you're fighting for Ukraine or you're tied to Azov, that's okay. That's it.
Yep. Yeah. Luckily, they bought it. And so I ended up taking care of my grandmother, which she started going downhill fast over the 3 years. And, no, man, it was just sickening just watching her, because there was the stages, when you start seeing the early signs of stages of somebody dying, you'll end up seeing the way they're sitting there in a chair and their mind just went full on. Like somebody that's just staring off to the distance, but they can hear you, but they can't speak or respond to you. I ended up getting stages like that from her. And also when she started trying to stand up and try to walk, her lower legs were not responding, and she'll just literally lose her strength and fall back down. Sometimes she'll just fall on the floor, and I have to literally run back downstairs and pick her off the floor. Yeah. Because my old man was trying to take care of her as well. And he also started going downhill fast with early stages of dementia. The amount of stress of just waking up every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning just to get her ready to take her to dialysis every 3 days a week. And it's just the amount of stress that he went through, it just literally tore him apart piece by piece, to where the stages of his dementia basically brought on the worst of his stress.
Yeah,
the way he was struggling to remember, struggling to calculate, and also struggling sometimes to remember what day it is, because sometimes I end up having to remind him, or his daughters had to end up giving them a heads up of a call early time to remind them that they had to go to the appointment and also see dialysis. But before the last year, which is somewhere in, let's see, she died in September. So I received the news in October that the doctor that was treating her, his name was Dr. My memories is a bit kind of fuzzy. I got the doctor's name on my phone. Dr. Paul, that Dr. Paul. Mm-hmm. He was the one that was treating her for 3 years straight. And finally, the final results was so bad that he ended up calling my grandmother into the hospital and said, he was about to cry in tears, because how in the world can you tell somebody you're dying? That is a hard thing as a doctor when you're treating patients. And he said, the only thing that's keeping you alive right now is dialysis. Your entire organs, kidneys, heart, and lungs is beyond damage and repair. And so once there's a certain amount of days you stop going dialysis, that is it. The only question is how many days you got left living. In other words, the stages I was seeing, the way she was acting, trying to get out the chair or trying to get into the wheelchair, and also the way she quits responding sometimes when she falls, that was like I was seeing the early stages of her dying. And then when I finally heard the news from Dr. Paul, I was like, I better spend as much time as I got left as possible, because I never grew up with my father or mother, because my father was murdered in Houston, Texas, when I was 7. And my mother, to this day, I have no idea where the heck she is, because she just ran off on me and my sister. So it was my grandmother and my grandfather that raised me my entire life. So me trying to run off the war, which was very, very too early and very too soon. Where it was just wrong, just a bail on them when they needed me the most. Oh, so I just continue staying behind, taking care of them. And a bit, I lost you.
Yeah.
I think I lost you.
Yeah. I got you back.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to move the on a little bit right here. I think the Wi-Fi is the one that's causing it. Yeah, I think that's it. There we go. Mm-hmm. Well, anyways, by the time I ended up finally getting another job, which I'm an experienced welder and also an experienced welder, so I can do underwater welding assistance while being
that's a high paying, high risk job. I had some friends who went into that. That's
I did it for the money, but also I did it for a reason, because I knew it was bad inflation in the United States.
Right.
Since the Afghanistan war and the Iraq war, they never fixed that problem. But when I was finally maybe 2 weeks in on my new job, I was working in Southeastern Industrial. And by the time I was, I think I was on the run of delivering an order that I finished working on. I was working on ballast tanks, welding ballast tanks and trailers. Then finally I received a phone call from my sister saying the end is near. She's now in a nursing a hospice bed that's now been moved into the house, to where a couple of days ago she was talking fine and normally, but then she ended up going into the second phase of dying, to where the body started breaking down, to where she couldn't talk. You got to end up sponge feeding her, giving her morphine just to numb the pain, and she started coughing up Espen, if that's what I think it's called, nasty stuff, and it smells horrible.
Yeah.
After hearing that news, I immediately call an Uber just to rush home. I never drove. I don't drive a car. So I ended up calling an Uber home, just to rush home. And for 2 days straight, I was watching her, trying to monitor her, trying to take care of her. And my grandfather was just, that hurt me the most, because he was literally just clinging on to her right next to her on the side of the hospital bed. Then finally, on the second day, I didn't sleep at all for those 2 nights. I was just sitting there in front of her, just watching her, trying to monitor her. And then on the second night, when I was a little bit dozing off and trying to sleep, I heard her last breath just go. And I rushed over there next to her, hold on to her hand, and she was gone. And my grandfather just basically broke down in tears and just clinged onto her body while I closed her eyes, slid the blanket over her, and then called up hospice and called the family over and told them the news. And then they hauled her out. They hauled her out on the chassis, which the funeral home will come over and pick up the body. I kissed her on the head one last time and slid the cover over her, and they hauled her off. And then the funeral happened. I was the pallbearer that carried her to her final resting place. And then just stay behind and watch her being buried in the ground until my job was done. And after she passed, it was like the shackles just finally came off. And I was free to actually come over and fight for Russia. So it took another 5 months, I have to say, because it was in September, October, November, December. January. So it was about 5 months. And it was just hard just remembering that, because I was leaving everybody I knew behind, but also people that really didn't understand anything about the outside world. I was the only one that understood a bit about it, because I was reading from books and history books. And this is where I learned very nasty thing about Israelis. When I arrived in Qatar, when I arrived in Qatar, you end up coming across a lot of Israelis that come through there.
Right. Yeah. There
are a lot. And when I saw the nasty attitudes from these people, I'm like, no wonder God didn't even choose you as a chosen people anymore.
Yeah. They, yeah. Yeah. I've ran into it before in different airports. It's an experience.
It is an experience for me, because I also learned when I was becoming a Russian Orthodox Christian in the United States, I was going to the Reigning Mother of God. That's the name of the church in North Carolina. And this is when I started getting active with Russian communities. Mm-hmm. Very, very nice people, very traditional. It's like living back in the 50s with these people.
Yeah, true.
Gentlemen. True. Where you shake your hands, being polite, saying good morning, good afternoon, and good night. It literally brought back more self-respect into me, just being around these people more than I am being around with bozos, dodos of the United States.
Yeah, the culture in the U.S. has seriously degraded.
Well, like I said, it's a society of social decay. When you have that stage in a nation, it takes away the self-respect and decency.
Yeah, it does. We left the U.S. We immigrated back in 2010. Last time I was in the U.S. was 2018. And yeah, it was... And you know what got me? Because I used to, after the military, I did a lot of corporate work. And you don't notice how much you censor yourself. And you don't have to censor yourself in Russia. And I was staying at my parents' place while my parents were here getting their residency, and I was talking to their neighbors, and I thought I was censoring myself, and you look at their eyes like, nope, you know, they're in shock because they're just saying things the way they are. I'm like, man, I can't ever go back. I'd get fired from any job I had in the U.S. because I'm used to actually being able to say what I want to say. And they're not radical things to say, but America is so self-censored. So
I mean, it's not only that, it's the amount of corruption in the society with the propaganda as well. That's what also damaged the society. The way they actually believe in this type of garbage.
Oh, yeah.
And that creates the stages of really, really socialist politics in the nation itself. That's where America is heading. But it's more like towards the USSR, Nazi Germany kind of thing, but mostly towards Nazi Germany, because that's literally the way Americans are acting. Because they still have the mindset of being racist. The amount of racism I hear in the United States is almost on the same level as the Israelis, but the Israelis are literally 200 times worse.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's very much true. So from Qatar, you flew up to Russia, or did you have to go to...
Well, I left from Atlanta Airport because I got banned from Charlotte International Airport.
Really?
They wouldn't let me back. Yeah. After just getting the...
Oh, damn. They didn't ban you. I wanted the
bill permit charge. They banned me from that airport. I'm like, well, okay, screw this airport. I have another choice to pick from.
That's interesting. How'd you find out you were banned from the airport?
Oh, they came up in front of me and just told me straight up.
Oh, damn.
When I was being detained, they came up in front of me and told me straight up, being put in handcuffs.
Wow. Okay.
Well, I like the honesty, though, because at least they had the balls to do it.
True, very true. You don't have to buy a ticket and then show up and find out you've been banned.
That can save some money.
Yeah. So you flew out of flew out of the U.S. from Atlanta. You go to Qatar, and then from Qatar up to Russia?
Yeah, I had to catch the next flight the next day. So I was really jet lagged by the time I arrived in Qatar. And I also got a chance to tour Qatar in the airport. Magnificent infrastructure, I must say. And the food there was delicious. And there was this one dish with the rice, with the spicy beef with gravy. I can't remember what this dish is. I think it was Bangladesh dish. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is. Very delicious to say. And I got to meet a lot of type of Muslims there in Qatar. And I came across a lot of Persians there as well.
Mm-hmm. So where'd you arrive? Did you go through Moscow or one of the other airports?
I went to the SVO airport, where I made a lot of good contacts there. And that was actually the first place I went to when I arrived in Moscow yesterday. Because you see, my police officer friend that helped me get my contract still works at that police at the airport. And I was going there to pick up a few things that he helped buy for me to when I go sign my next contract again. And I was on my way there to pick it up, but he was still working on duty. He's still getting phone calls, moving left and right around the airport. It was just a bad time yesterday to even talk to him. So I came straight to the hotel I booked, literally not far from the airport, and just came here, relaxed, eat some good meals that I haven't had in so long. Just eating straight up borscht, soup, macaroni. The macaroni was hard on me when it goes to the toilet.
Yeah. So you sign the contract because you know what the usual stereotypes in the West are. They'll hoodwink you into signing something, and then if you're a foreigner, they'll just throw you. They don't give you any training. They don't feed you. They throw you up front into body waves because that's what Putin fights, is just all constant body waves. There's like a quadrillion dead Russians laying everywhere against Well, I think what Zelensky said, there's like 30,000 Ukrainians have died. Like, on which day?
I would like to see the calculations on that. But what I learned...
When you're sorting off cocaine, you don't need calculations.
When you snort cocaine, you just say, fuck it, just send whatever we got available.
Yeah, the Zelensky approach.
Yep.
As long as the Colombian marching powder keeps coming, it's all good.
Yeah, by the time they get at the front, most of the guys just die straight away, which is sad, really. But
Ukrainian guys.
the thing is that what we're dealing with is just basically straight up Nazi Germany all over again in Ukraine. Especially when they got the first Ukrainian of the 14th Volunteer Infantry, SS Galicia, first Ukrainian Azov battalions, which they're using the same insignia from the original SS division that committed atrocities and war crimes in the war.
Yeah, the SS Galicia didn't really fight too well. They got their asses kicked in the first battle. So then they got transferred to do the job they were really good at doing, concentration camp guards.
Concentration camp guard and also doing genocidal human civilian hunts as
Oh,
well.
yeah. They're really good at,
The
you know.
same with this other two divisions, which they were traitors of Russia. They were Russian SS divisions as well. And then you had Muslim SS divisions as well, but they didn't do a lot of fighting because they mostly ran away from the fight. But the second division as well that fought in Belarus was created out of homosexual rapists, child murderers, and literally actual serial killers. The worst of the worst that was created. Mostly created to do nothing but genocide against civilians.
Yeah, absolutely. So you sign the contract, and what happens next?
Well, when I arrived in Moscow, this is where I fucked up what I should have done in Qatar because I forgot about the sanctions. When I forgot about the sanctions and then arrived in Moscow at the SVO airport, I was like thinking to myself, because I started having some worries of that I forgot about something. And then when I went to the vending machine to try to get something at the vending machine, I pulled out my Visa card and tried to get something. And I was like, decline, decline, because I know there's dang money on this thing. And then I was like, oh, damn it. The
Sanctions.
sanctions. I can't use it. I
Yeah,
don't have the rubles on me,
unfortunately,
so I
yeah.
don't have any money.
That's bad. That's
Yep.
really bad.
It was really bad. So as soon as I got through with the interview with the FSB, it wasn't until the next day I was allowed to go through the gate and then finally go into the airport. So finally I said, well, I got no money, so I can't really tour in Moscow. Fuck it, I might as well just go straight to the military office. So I guess just go straight to the nearest police officer and ask him if he can help me get a contract. So that's what I did. So they brought me to the head capitan of the police force. I forget the dude's name. Jack as heck. I believe he already served in the military before because he literally looked like he worked out a lot. And he helped me get situated straight away. But I still needed money to open up a bank account and also get a SIM card. So I was still broke because I had no single ruble on me except for 50 rubles.
Yeah, that's not much these days, unfortunately. Once upon a
Nope,
time,
not
you could
much.
do something with that.
It's like a 1 cent penny.
Yeah.
And that's literally all I had for change and also a torn up $50 bill that nobody seemed to want to take. So I just donated to the guy and said, "Here, it's from an American. Straight up, you can have it. It's useless to me. I can't get rid of it."
So how to what did they do to get you? I mean.
Well, I went to the military office for 4 straight days, so they kept on bringing me back and forth from the airport. So I was basically spending my nights with the police officers in their barracks, which they fed me. They gave me places to shower and places to sleep, even though it was a hard wooden table to sleep on, but it was enough for me. And after 4 straight days of trying to solve this issue with my bank, I was finally able to get my bank account open with this police officer I tried to visit at the airport. He's the one that helped me get my bank account open and my SIM card, my Megaphone SIM card to work. And then I signed the paperwork to get my contract in process. Then I was shipped off to a place near the Armed Forces Temple. I'm not going to say the name of the place where they sent me to here because it involves children. And I don't like seeing children get involved in danger. So I didn't want to put those kids in harm's way. Mm-hmm. So they kept us there for 3 months, even though I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks. I was there for 3 months, and that gave me enough time to train. Because while we were there, they gave us training AK weapons. The motto of the AK-108. So we were training with those for 3 months. Storm tactics, medical training as well, learning how to use the tourniquet, morphine, and also showing us certain photos of wounds that we got to look out for, and certain organ and vital areas that we got to stop from bleeding. And also they were teaching us about drone warfare, where we were learning all different types of drones as well that we needed to look out for. And this is how I learned very quickly how to deal with Baba Yagas and kamikazes. I hate those things. I call them pests.
Oh, yeah. The first time it hit home for me, it was in 23, and I'm visiting up at the front lines. I've been up there about 14 times, front lines and near rear. Brought some equipment up there, and I had to go take a dump and go around the back of a building. You know, in the old days, I'm out of view of any snipers. Nobody's going to drop an artillery round or even a mortar round on one guy, kind of.
And then you hear that buzzing sound, it's like, oh, crap.
Well, thankfully, I didn't hear the buzzing sound, but it hit me, and I'm sitting there doing my what I need to do, and I just start thinking, doing, man, if somebody drops a grenade on my head right now, this just sucks. If you have all the ways to go out, right, you know.
The drones that you don't hear that end up sneaking up on you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, if it's high enough up, you're not going to hear that drone probably sitting over you just hovering, dropping a grenade on top of your head. It was just, you know, of all the ways to go. And I'm just a visitor, and guys are sitting up there every day, every time you go take a dump or something, and you got to wonder, you know, am I going to come back from this? Somebody's going to drop a grenade on my head. How did daddy die? Oh, he was taking a shit. That's kind of, yeah.
It's not the best way to go.
No, I can think of 1,000 better ways, you know, at least a little hurrah there, but you know, that's the reality.
You can think of a better way to die, just have a sword fight in the middle of a battlefield where everybody was trying to kill each other with rifles. And then you end up getting defeated by being stabbed by a saber.
Yeah. Oh, you know, that better than having a grenade dropped on your head by a drone while taking a dump. But that's just reality. That's a modern reality.
Yeah. The way this all worked out is Scott explained it. When civilians started bringing technology to the front to the soldiers because they were not being properly supplied. Heck, they were not. Trained and modified like this because their job before this operation started was just a peacekeeping military special operation.
Yep.
Meaning that they were designed to bring the Ukrainians to the negotiating table. They were not designed for a war.
For the initial war, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And when all this happened, it was more of like a rush hour where these guys had to literally man the lines and started digging in and entrenchment. So because of that, they were lacking supplies, they were lacking the resources, and they didn't have a supply chain or a network yet to supply them. So who better to call up than your own babushka and your own wife? So they were the ones, the women of Russia started getting together and started strategizing of what their men need. So they started writing down the list of what they can get at the shop. And then bring it to the front. And once they've received this stuff at the front, then they can start remodifying it to their own advantage to use against the Ukrainians. That's when the observation of using drones, like in World War One, when they were using the Albatross before they converted it into the Albatross, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Albatross, if I remember, they didn't convert it into a fighter until near the mid stages of the war when they started putting machine guns on it.
Yeah, they used to. It was reconnaissance, and then they do have dogfights by shooting pistols at each other.
Well, they did mount the machine gun in the rear cockpit of the plane.
But even that was later. First, they just started. They were just shooting.
They also had. They also had. What I saw in the old videos and footages is that they bolted two pistols together to make it look like a machine gun, and then they were just literally pointing it at the plane and trying to shoot the gas tanks.
Yep. Yeah. It all started so quaint.
And this is another lesson that people need to learn. When you learn about this military operation, study the past wars like World War I, the final stages of the Industrial Revolution, how rapidly weapons started being created to be modified for certain battles and strategies that needed to be fought. Like seeing the first tank on the battlefield, for instance, that's got to literally make your heart drop and end up feeling dread like crazy seeing that for the first time. And also end up seeing planes fighting each other, which I bet you it was a heck of a view to see that, seeing that on the ground, looking up like, huh, oh, I know this pilot right here. He had certain multiple kills here. And this guy here, I think he's new. It's what I heard from the guys here.
Yeah. The first use of tanks broke two German divisions. Problem is the tanks broke down too. So.
Well, that was the downfall of new creations of weapons. So not all weapon will work on the first day. Oh, so. Yeah.
But it did. I mean, it broke two German divisions and it ran.
I mean, it did the job what it was supposed to do, but there will always be flaws in weapons. You can't expect them to work 100%. That's where you have to have the servers that created these things stay at the rear of the front that's watching the battles of how these things are functioning to start taking notes to know what type of upgrades and modifications they need to improve it. Yep. So that's what the Russians did with the Arushniks, the artillery, the tanks, the BMPs. That's when they started remodifying the doctrines for these vehicles to know that, okay, there's a certain amount of vehicles and equipment we're losing. We need to remodify the armors on these things.
Well, what? How? I mean, with Russian as a language, how difficult was it on training and communicating?
That was a one solid brick wall that I ran into when I finally got into the front. Because as soon as I got there, I only learned enough where I understood the commands and tasks that they wanted me to do. And then when I finally realized that I'm only surrounded by guys that only speak Russian, and I'm like, oh shit.
Well, that's where to learn full immersion. You got no choice.
Yeah, and then I was like trying to learn it every day, but the situation I was in, also getting mortared on and shelled on, because the first place they sent me to when I was trained for 3 months in Moscow, here in Moscow, and then trained for 1 week and 9 days in Crimea on my actual training, I was sent off to Kherson in entrenchment. So my job was to sit there and wait for the Ukrainians to storm us, to come to us. So I was close enough where I could hear the sirens going off. So I know I was very close to the enemy. And while I was there, I realized that trying to study this language is going to be difficult, because I'm also thinking about what's coming over that lake across that river there. And it, oh man, that was literally the struggle I had to literally deal with, was the language. Because not only as I'm in the middle of studying, but then there's some occasions where they started opening up artillery and mortars on us, and then I'm like, had to drop everything and hit the deck.
Yeah. Oh, I understand. But that's the best way to learn, though. You actually have no choice here. You've got to learn. Everyone else speaks the language around you.
Yo, buddy, world.
Yep. So... Did you see any other foreigners in your unit?
Yeah, I served with four foreigners. Well, there's only three of us that came out of there, came out of that place in Bakhmut alive. They went off to fight in Chesapeake. And God bless their souls. They were sent off to a storm detachment. And I believe they were only out there for 1 month. And I believe on the 1 month they got there and being out there, they were just sent off to a storm detachment. Mm-hmm. And I believe they were arriving at their building destination. And when they got there, they stayed there for 1 week until, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, a drone, an enemy drone was spotting a movement in that area and sent an FPV drone and artillery strikes on that area, blew it up and killed both of them inside.
Mm, yeah. This is
which that place is, oh man, that place is literally a valley of death, because as you're trying to go to the front line, you're seeing fresh dead body here, fresh dead body here, fresh dead body here, fresh dead body here, just trying to get out there to the front to man the trenches and man the lines. And it's literally death by drones most of the time. And you rarely see these guys getting killed by artillery. And there's this drone nowadays. It's like a size of this phone right here. Mm-hmm. And what they will do is attach a mortar shell that you see. You see these big fat ammunition that the U.S. Army used when they launched these mortar grenades?
Yeah, yeah.
They'll duct tape a mortar grenade onto these small drones, and you can't hear this thing things when it comes up near you. There's been a few death occasions where these guys were killed out of nowhere, and they didn't even hear this thing when it approached.
Yeah, yeah, that technology is... yeah, that technology is pretty bad. I've got nothing good to say about it.
That's probably when I first experienced dealing with dead bodies, was when I was in Bakhmut. Because instead of putting me in storm where I was supposed to go, I kind of lost you there. My phone just went blank. Are we still here?
I see you. I see you.
Okay. When I was sent to Bakhmut, I was in training for... Because when I was in Kherson, I was there for 5 months straight on the front lines entrenchment. And then after 5 months, they sent me to the rear. And that's when I got my interview with RT News. Mm-hmm. Just by, I didn't even know that was the reason why I was being brought to the rear, was for an interview. I was like scratching my head, like, why am I here? I don't like the place. It's too dang quiet. I ain't getting shelled on or chased by drones. What the heck is going on? And yeah. So that was also another remnants I saw from the war, was seeing the wounded being brought to the rear, because they had a medical facility there where they tried to stabilize the patients before sending them to the hospital. So I saw the amount of damage of drone warfare. And a lot of these guys got injured from Baba Yaga's, but also storm fighting as well. Because where we were at in Kherson, these guys, the Ukrainians will try to attack somewhere in the afternoon and at night on boats. So they will try to do a raid attack on boats. It doesn't work out too well, because as soon as they try to get across, they all get gunned down like they were nothing but like a pest. You just swat it out of the way with a fly swatter. And then they just end up floating down river, all dead on a raft boat. That is a nasty thing to do to these guys, but heck, war is war, and you ain't got no choice. It's either he kills you or you kill him.
Yep, absolutely. How often were they doing these raft attacks?
I wasn't near the water to see it, but I actually got videos of the guys that were stationed near that cove and on the bridge that leads into Kherson, that was actually mowing these guys down a lot of times. Also, we were doing a lot of island raid attacks, trying to take a little chunk. Try to liberate, I think we're still trying to liberate Kherson, the main city of Kherson, yeah, from the yeah. region. But there still is a lot of quietness and a little less attacks from these guys, but I think they did these attacks maybe every once 2 or 4 weeks. They'll try to end up sending two boats out to do a raid attack, and they mostly all get gunned down. like for nothing.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at was it was it Kupinsk? It was I cannot think of the name of the little village on north of Kherson. They put down the Ukrainians kept bringing in Marines, and they wound up losing
I
two.
think that's Kupi, what
Kupiansk,
was it?
Kupiansk.
Kupiansk.
Yeah, it's a
Yeah.
little
I saw
village,
the videos of that.
three parallel streets. They put down two infantry battalions or two Marine battalions. And they just bring them in
Yeah, I
and
saw
get
that. These
artillery to
guys
death,
were.
bring in the next group, get artillery to death, and do that for 4 months. That's just insane.
They were just being sent in nothing but into a slaughterhouse, the way
Yeah,
I
yeah.
saw it. Because I know the two Marines that were fighting the Ukraine Marines on that front. That you had the Marines and the paratroopers, I think, that were fighting on that part of the front. And I met these guys when I was brought into the rear in Lugansk, stationed there for our training for 4 months. Yes, I stayed in the rear, and I think it was Shalenka where I was staying at. I could have got the name wrong where I was staying at. I was there for 3 months because that's how long they kept me there. Also, it's because they didn't want to send me back out there in entrenchment after they found out that I was an American hanging around in the rear, just helping out with the wounded as best as I can, because just keep myself busy. I don't like to be the guy just sitting around doing nothing because
Right.
that ends up irritating the crap out of me. So I end
So
up going out and finding things to do, like, oh, we need to dig another dugout. I'll end up helping the guys dig out that dugout and start building it. Or if they needed help with the wounded, I'll go up to the medical facility, help bring in the wounded, or get them all shipped out to the hospital.
right. Oh, that's just a good thing. So the oh, I was gonna ask, good Lord. The you we were talking before I don't
We were
remember
talking about Kupiansk, I believe.
we yeah before Kupiansk, before we started this we were talking about the Ukrainian POWs and you saw your first
Oh,
Ukrainian POW and,
I believe this is after I was taken out of Bakhmut. I was in Bakhmut for 4 months dealing with wounded. Guys that literally got battered to death, not seriously wounded, but wounded enough to where they couldn't keep up with the physical pace of running back and forth, carrying heavy boxes of ammunition, and also getting battered to death with their bruises and injuries. And I believe a couple guys ended up having organ problems and a hernia problem. So I was taking care of these guys. And it wasn't until I was called back to the rear after spending 4 months out there that I was brought out of Bakhmut, and I got a good picture view of this city. Which Prigozhin gave this place hell when
Oh
I
yeah,
first arrived
it's
there. It's literally nothing but rubble, like the city of Stalingrad all over again. And to get through this entire place, it's like a minefield. Because you also got to look where you're stepping. Because I ended up noticing that still there is a mine here. There's a rocket warhead here that still hasn't gone off, but it can go off at any moment. And there's a mortar shell here that's just sticking about a quarter inch out the ground that still could go off at any moment.
Oh yeah, that's the debris of war. Yeah, I've been in areas like that. That's just it rains hard enough, things start exploding.
Oh yeah, and also sometimes you get liquor up an artillery shell coming out of nowhere, and when you hear that thing whistling, you know it's time to hit the deck and back off somewhere high, just to avoid the shrapnel that'll be blown all over the place.
So when you saw this Ukrainian, you were talking about how malnourished he was.
Oh God. I wish I got in a picture of the dang thing, but I wanted to respect his boundaries, so I didn't take a photo of this guy. When I arrived in Stakhanov, that's where I arrived at when they brought me to the rear. And mind you, getting there was kind of a hassle because the road was it was snowing, and the road was mixed with salt and ice, especially when you're trying to drive on a road that has a bit of an ice problem. You tend to kind of struggle a little bit trying to get there with the traction. But the military vehicles that they brought me in the rear with had good traction to drive over ice, so it was not a problem getting back to Stakhanov. So when I arrived there, this is when I think I saw this guy was being shipped off to the hospital, which usually when you see a POW like this, you're not supposed to feed them until they actually get the proper medicine and treatment to stabilize them before they can start eating. Because usually when you try to feed somebody like this that hasn't eaten in a good long while and has been starving for a good long many weeks or 1 month, it ends up probably killing them faster. You have a higher risk of probably killing them.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was like hesitant at first of trying to feed this guy, but he was just looking so pitiful. I saw his rib cage and the shirt he was wearing, and also how much of his gut had just sucked in to his belly to where he was not properly nutrients at all. And plus he hasn't bathed in a long time. So I could smell how bad this guy was.
Oh, I bet.
And so when I was thinking to myself that even though I was at war against this guy, at the same time, at the end of the day, at the end of the battle, we're all human beings. No matter what end of the gun sight you're on, you're still a human being and you're still killing a human being, but it's war.
Right.
So out of respect for this guy, I went to the store across the street, got him a kielbasa, clip, and a Dobre de Cola. And I walked out of there and handed it to the guy. Well, I handed it to the guy that was taking him to the medical facility. And I told him, don't give it to this guy until he actually started getting proper treatment. And then it's okay to hand it to him because, you, like I said, you still have a high risk of killing him if you feed him too early.
Yep, yep. It's a lot of concentration camp inmates. When they were liberated, a lot of them died because they fell on the food and started eating, hadn't been eating, and yeah, they bloated up and died from that. So
that's what I also learned from history. When you learn this kind of stuff from history, and then when you see it in real life, you end up having a kind of an experience of what you read out of the book. And
yep.
That's when you start having to have precautions of what you're supposed to do in that situation.
Yep.
But also I was in the medical field for 4 months with my doctor and also with my driver. Code name was Driver. Yeah, because literally his job was to drive you in and drive you out real fast.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we used to drive straight up to the front lines back in 22, 23, delivering aid, things like that. You can't go up there now. I mean, it's foot only. People don't realize that. But Christ, you try driving up there, you're a dead man most of the time. Drones just friggin' everywhere.
This is the reason why the roads in Bakhmut now is a city of chicken wires and chicken nets.
Oh yeah, we were even in Avdiivka, and yeah, it's the
oh god, that is even worse because I was told that there's an American that went there. I actually was speaking to him when I first signed my contract because that's where he got sent off to, was in Avdiivka. He didn't say that's where he was, but the way he was describing it tells me that's where he was.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, oh, Lord, I know this guy is going through worse hell than I am.
Yeah, I've been to Avdiivka a couple of times. The civilians are starting to come back. But, you know, and the last time we're walking around, you know, we're just in camo, no, and have my Kevlar on, don't have any body armor on. Nobody does. And there are drones getting shot down overhead. You know, it's just like everybody's just walking around. I mean, and we have drone attacks coming in. And I was talking to some of the locals. We just stopped off at a shop, and the girl's like, yeah, every single day. They're bringing drones in every single day. So, but and we were, what, maybe about 20 kilometers at this point from the front line. It's the near rear.
Well, there's a good distance reach for leakers and kamikazes and Bobby Ugas to come through.
It wasn't even 20. I think it was like 16, somewhere around there. I was actually bringing an American there to see it. And it turned, we were going to go further, but it turned out I had to get a special permit for him to go further. Because he had... my buddy that was escorting us, he's a captain. He's like... And it was Cameron McGregor who was with me. And he's like, man, if anything happens to him, I might as well get killed too.
Yeah, because only fair, because you end up having the guilt of like, dang, I actually got this guy killed.
Well, no, it was worse than that, because it wasn't just the guilt. It's you have to answer to your command. Why did the American guy get killed? So it's like it's just easier to get killed along with him and not have to go through all that.
Get through the dang documents of like trying to report of what actually happened to this guy. How did he get killed? It's like.
Well, they have it even worse when people like myself come up there, because we're former military, so it's like, artillery overhead, okay. Nothing new. It's civilians get scared, and they don't want to go further. We're the idiots that go, I've seen it before, heard it before, nothing new. And they get really nervous around people like us. It's like, that survival instinct is at a much lower level. It's like,
good soldiers is like, you can just brush it off and just say, I've been out there underneath this kind of crap for so long, it's laid just nothing. I could just brush it off. And then when a civilian hears you talk like that, it's like, I wonder if this guy's in his right mind. I'm kind of nervous about sitting next to him.
I was visiting my aunt and uncle in Yasinavata a couple of years ago. And, Yasinavata's been shelled for 13 years. It's not really getting shelled anymore because the front's moved enough. Thank God. They don't get it that often. It's more rockets, if anything, but they were getting shelled almost on a daily basis. And we're standing there in the front yard, and I can hear the 155s flying over my head, one here, one there, blowing up somewhere in the city. And one of the guys that was with us, he was a civilian, he'd never heard artillery in his life. And he's all nervous and nervous. I looked at him, it's like, Misha, you're not going to hear the one that kills you, you're just going to meet Jesus. Don't worry about it. That was the wrong words to say. He freaked. He just absolutely freaked out. Like, we gotta go. We gotta get out of here. We gotta go. It's like, calm down. I mean, look. My elderly aunt and uncle have been living under this for how many years? Like, well, what are you afraid of? And don't worry about the house. If it lands on the house, 155, you ain't gonna survive that either. just relax. You can't handle. If you're meant to die by an artillery round, you're just meant to die by an artillery round. There's nothing you can do about it.
It's more of like, if it happens, it happens.
Yeah.
Well, I never served in the military before. I never did want to serve a colonial military, because that's basically what the United States is now, since it postured itself like that as a mercenary colonial military. The Russian military was the only one I was ever going to choose to have redemption and redeem myself and my honor. And mostly it's a actual proper military to actually have something to fight for. At least you have a reason to fight for. When I joined the Russian military, I was kind of preparing myself for what I was going to face. And I know probably mostly on the first day when you arrive at the front, you'll mostly have your first meeting with an artillery shell. So I was like thinking to myself, I wonder what's the sound of the guns when they start roaring. And then when I finally arrived at the front and hearing the echoes of these boom, 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 and hearing, and it's like, I can understand the noise like this. You can sometimes struggle to sleep a little bit, but after a couple of days, you can just sleep it off.
Yep.
It ain't until you start getting shelled on by these things yourself, which I was witnessing these things on a couple of daily basis, of getting shelled on and mortared on. And you can feel the shock wave of these things when they struck near you. And when it happens so loud of a boom to where you just end up getting shaken up. The only first thing you can think of is like, hit the deck, run inside, and duck for cover.
Yeah, I mean, you get explosions going up 400 or 500 meters from you, and the windows are shaking. Everything's shaking. Most people don't understand how big of a concussion wave actually goes off. You know, the most extreme concussion wave was actually when I was stationed at Vilsack, which is right beside Grafenwöhr training grounds. And about 15, 20 kilometers away was the tank ranges. And when tanks fire, they're firing, the round is leaving Mach 2, so you get a sonic boom. And even 20 kilometers away, your windows are rattling from that sonic boom.
Oh, yeah. You can actually also feel the floor also rattling.
Oh, yeah. But the concussion wave is something. I mean, that was probably the most extreme concussion wave is just tanks firing. And they're firing downrange on a constant range. But, yeah, when you're inside the tank and you're firing, you don't feel it that much. I mean,
you're outside of the tank on the ground, you feel it.
Yeah. And I'm telling you, my apartment on base was 20 kilometers away, 16, 20, somewhere there. And your windows would shake with every round.
You still can feel the shock wave of that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So when you get that explosion 500 meters away from you and everything's shaking, yeah, or closer, yeah, it's a whole different reality then. And yeah, people don't get that if they've never experienced that.
Oh, man, I got my experience of what these things can do to a person because – I think it was maybe 3 weeks in of staying out there. No, it'll be 4 weeks. 4 weeks of staying out there on my first day of entrenchment, which I was still sick as a dog. When I arrived at the front, I was sick as a dog with the season sickness.
Oh, the flu.
Where I was coughing heavily, coughing snot out. And I felt like also I got through pneumonia when I came over. To Russia as well, so that's what also hit me even worse was the after effect of the pneumonia that was hitting me hard in my chest and my lungs. I'm like, I hope I get struck by an artillery shell that ends this man's sickness.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was literally just struggling every day for a couple of days with the sickness, and then finally when I opened my mouth about that and gone downstairs trying to get myself a cup of coffee, boom, I felt the entire room shook, and I dropped the pot that was boiling hot water. And I said, well, time to run to the banya. We can't stand there in there, no windows. Go to a solid wall and closed room. I went straight to the banya. We were all just jammed in there, just trying to ride out the artillery bombardment. And we forgot the dog outside. And that poor dog, it hit the kennel and the yard she was staying in directly. Destroyed the entire metal door. And then when we looked and saw the damage, we were like, I wonder if the dog is okay. And then we didn't have time to worry about that until we can ride out the bombardment. And then when we went out to look at the battle assessment damage, it literally created a huge crater. And we were like trying to see where the dog was at. And then when I turned around back at the building where the door was blown off, I saw her carcass laying right there. The poor thing, at least it was quick. But when you look at the wall, the way the artillery shell exploded, a lot of people don't know that a shell itself doesn't directly kill you. It's the blast of the shrapnel that starts flying around that will kill you.
Yep, yep.
And this dog died from a shrapnel blast that killed her instantly, ripped her entire back spine out.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And that's how I learned very quick of that. That could be me as a human being standing right there where that poor dog was at.
Yeah, you get a chunk of metal, twisted metal like that flying through. It's nasty shit. Much worse than getting shot.
Much worse than getting shot. But if you survive, I can believe the amount of pain you got to be in.
Whew. Yeah, I agree. Seth, we've got a time hack. I've got another call I need to get to. I want to thank you for joining the call and telling your story. And it goes a lot, to counter all the propaganda that, particularly in the U.S. and in the West. But...
Oh, man, I never trusted the United States government or the propaganda all my life. Heck, I never even voted in the United States because there was nothing to trust or support in the first place.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's actually gone that way. So one bot group or another, but there's a lot of truth in that, absolute truth in that. Seth, thank you. Thank you for joining the call. Everybody, thank you. If you've got any questions, leave in the comments. Seth will have the link so he can answer any comments as he wishes. And if you want any of his advice or anything, if you want, we can leave your contacts in the description.
You can leave my Telegram chat in the description.
Okay.
Or if I'm not responding, you can link it back to 8 minutes.
Okay.
I'm also in contact with him. Also, I believe today I'm supposed to be meeting with Chris in the center of Moscow.
Oh, Halali. Yeah. I was just, I had just had Halali on my podcast yesterday. So we had a good conversation.
Yeah, I was just watching. I didn't get a chance to finish it because I dozed off with a sleeping medicine.
Yeah, Halali's a good guy. He's a very good guy.
Oh, yeah, he is. I can tell he is. He's actually very hyped to see me today.
Cool. Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'll definitely be seeing you too. But everybody, thank you. Thank you very much. And we'll see you in the next one. Leave some comments.